group of people walked out, all but one dressed in dark robes with hoods drawn up. The unhooded exception, Rini was surprised to see, was the pale singer from the lounge. Or was it? The face, especially the huge, haunted eyes, looked the same. But this one's hair was a great curling auburn cascade, and she also seemed taller and longer-limbed. Before Rini could make up her mind, several of the robed figures stepped forward and grabbed the pale woman, who did not resist. The music shuddered, and a quickening beat began to make itself felt beneath the humming chords. The stage lengthened like a protruded tongue. The walls and tables and even the patrons also reshaped themselves, flowing around the woman and her attendants until the room surrounded the strange tableau like a hospital operating theater. The acid glow dimmed until everything was in shadow, and the woman's bone-white face seemed the only source of light. Then her robes were torn away, and her pale body leaped into view like a sudden flame. Rini took a sharp breath. She heard louder, harsher inhalations on all sides. The young woman was not shaped like the dream figure of male fantasy she would have expected in a place like this. Her long, slender legs, delicate ribcage, and small, mauve-tipped breasts made her seem little past adolescence. The girl at last raised her dark eyes to look at the audience. Her expression was a mixture of reproach and fear, but something else lurked beneath, a kind of disgust, almost a challenge. Someone shouted at her in a language Rini didn't understand. Close behind, another customer laughed explosively. With no sign of physical effort, the robed figures grabbed at the girl's four limbs and lifted her from the floor. She floated between them, extended and glowingly pale, something pure to be marked or shaped. The music dropped to a low, anticipatory hum. One of the dark figures twisted the girl's arm. She writhed, dull, dark veins and the bunching of tendons suddenly visible beneath the translucent skin, but did not make a sound. The arm was twisted and pulled farther. There was a gristly noise, as something tore, and the girl cried out at last. A choking, drawn-out sob. Rini turned away, her stomach lurching. "It's only pictures," she told herself. "Not real. Not real." Shapes hunched forward on either side, craning for a better view. People were shouting, their voices already hoarse. Rini could almost feel a kind of collective darkness flowing from the watchers, as though the room were filling with poisonous smoke. More things were happening on the stage. More movements, more gasping cries. She did not want to look. The brothers from Madras were rubbing their hands back and forth on their impressively muscled thighs. Strimbello, sitting next to Rini, watched the action with his small, fixed smile. It went on for long minutes. Rini stared at the floor, struggling against the urge to scream and run away. These people were animals. No, worse than animals. For what wild creature could dream of something so vile? It was time to take Khabu and get out. That wouldn't be enough to reveal their imposture. Surely not all patrons of even as foul a place as this wanted to see these kinds of things. She started to rise, but Strimbello's broad hand pushed down hard on her leg, trapping her.
"You should not go!"
His growl seemed to push its way deep into her ear.
"Look! You will have much to tell back home."
He reached his other hand up and pulled her chin around toward the stage. The girl's white limbs had been twisted into several impossible angles. One leg had been pulled to an obscene length, like a piece of taffy. The crowd was roaring now, so the girl's screams could no longer be heard. But her head snapped spastically from side to side, and her mouth gaped. One of the robed figures drew out something long and sharp and shiny. The clamor of the audience took on a different tone. A pack of dogs that had cornered some exhausted thing and now were baying for the kill. Rini tried to pull away from Strimbello's implacable grip. A piece of something wet and gleaming flew past her, arcing out into the shadowed seats. Someone behind her caught it and lifted it to his expressionless sim face. He smeared it against his cheeks as though daubing a ceremonial mask, then pushed it into his idiot mouth. Rini tasted sour liquid as her stomach heaved again. She tried to look away, but all around her the patrons were lifting their hands, grabbing at other bits flung out from the stage. Horribly, she could hear the girl's shrieks even above the barking crowd. She could not take this any longer. She would go mad if she remained. If a ritual object could burn, then this place should be burned to its dark foundation. She thrust her hand out toward Khabu, trying frantically to get his attention. The little man was gone. The spot he had occupied behind the Pavamanas was empty. "My friend!" She tried to tug herself free of Strimbello, who was unconcernedly watching the stage. "My friend is gone."
"No matter," said Strimbello. "He will find something he likes better."
"Then he is a fool," chortled one of the Pavamanas, grinning like a lunatic. Simulated blood gleamed on his cheeks like an old courtesan's rouge. "There is nothing like the Yellow Room.
Let me go. I have to find him."
The fat man turned to look at her, his grin widening.
"You are not going anywhere, my friend. I know exactly who you are. You are not going anywhere."
The room seemed to bend. His dark eyes held her, small holes that offered a glimpse into something dreadful. Her heart was thumping as it hadn't even in Leviathan's pool. She almost dropped offline before remembering Khabu. Perhaps he was caught somehow in the way Stephen had been caught. If she bailed out of the system, she might find him in the same death-like trance that had claimed her brother. He was an innocent, as much so as Stephen. She couldn't abandon him.
"Let me go, you bastard!" she shouted.
Strimbello's grip did not loosen. Instead, he pulled her closer, dragging her into his wide lap.
"Enjoy the performance, good sir," he said, "and then you will see more, much more."
The crowd was shouting, an almost deafening roar of sound, but Weenie could not think of the command to lower the volume. Something about the fat man submerged all her careful judgment in a flood of blind panic. She made a succession of gestures that accomplished nothing, then dredged up a command she hadn't used since her hacking days, splaying her fingers almost painfully wide and bowing her head. For a moment, the entirety of the Yellow Room seemed to freeze around her. A moment later, when it lurched back to life, she was several steps away from Strimbello, standing by herself on the floor before the stage. He stood, an expression of mild surprise on his broad features, and reached for her. Rini immediately moved herself out of the Yellow Room and onto the promenade. Even the bottomless well looked normal compared to what she had left behind. But the bushman's small sim was nowhere in sight. Strimbello would be on her in a moment.
"Khabu!"
She shouted his name on the private channel, then boosted it and shouted again.
"Khabu! Where are you?"
There was no answer. The little man was gone. Second, Red King's dream. Long has paled that sunny sky. Echoes fade and memories die. Autumn frosts have slain July. Still she haunts me, phantomwise, Alice moving under skies never seen by waking eyes. In a wonderland they lie, dreaming as the days go by, dreaming as the summers die, ever drifting down the stream, lingering in the golden gleam. Life, what is it but a dream? Lewis Carroll. Chapter 10. Thorns. Netfeed News. Agreement signed, but mistrust smolders in Utah. Visual. Men shaking hands in front of Capitol Building, Salt Lake City. V.O. A fragile three-way peace now exists between the Utah state government, the Mormon Church, and the militant Mormon separatists known as the Deseret Covenant. But some question whether it can last without federal involvement. Visual. President Anford in Rose Garden. The U.S. government, citing the rights of states and cities to self-determination, has so far declined to become involved, leading to complaints from some Utah citizens that the Anford administration has reneged on the Constitution. Others, however, applaud the administration's hands-off approach. Visual. Edgar Riley, Deseret spokesman at press conference. Riley. No government has a right to tell us what to do in God's country. There are some warriors out here. Hard men. If the state backtracks, we'll just shut everything down from the borders in. They come for you at dawn. It's Jankel, the nice one, and another named Simmons or something. You haven't seen him much. They used to send more than two, but times have changed. You haven't slept a wink, of course, but they come in quietly anyway. as though they don't want to startle you awake. It's time, Jenkel tells you. He looks apologetic. You shrug off his extended hand and stand up. You aren't going to let someone else help you. You'll go on your own two legs if you can, but your knees are pretty weak. You've heard their footsteps in the corridor, phantom precursors, so many times through the long night. Now you feel gritty at the edges, and blurry as a badly developed photograph. You're tired. Sleep is coming, though. You'll sleep soon. There's no priest or pastor. You told them you didn't want one. What kind of comfort could you get from some stranger babbling to you about something you don't believe in? Only Jenkel to escort you, and Simmons, or whatever his name is, holding the door. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 6. City of Golden Shadow. Otherland, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 166. Only a couple of low-wage prison bulls who need the overtime on a Sunday morning. They'll also pull a little bonus for doing this, of course, since it's one of the genuinely unpleasant jobs. No coercion of anyone but prisoners in the privatized penal system. Jenkel must need the money with all those high-tax kids to feed. Otherwise, who else but a psychopath would sign up for this particular task? The last walk. A shuffle, really, with those heavy-duty nylon restraints around your ankles. None of the things you've seen in flicks happen. The other inmates don't come to their bars and call terse farewells. Most of them are sleeping, or pretending to sleep. You've been through this yourself when they took Garza. What could you say? And Jenkel doesn't shout, "Dead man walking," or any of that other stuff. Never has. The closest he ever came was a quiet chat when you first came on the floor, where in best prison drama style he told you, "If you work with me, everything'll be smooth. If not, you'll be doing some real hard time." Now he looks quiet and sorry, like he's taking someone else's dog run over in the road to the emergency veterinarian. The place they take you isn't really a doctor's office. It is the death chamber, after all, but it has the look and smell of any prison surgery. The doctor is a small man, if he really is a doctor. You only need to be med-tech certified to perform an execution. He's obviously been waiting around about 15 minutes longer than he wanted to, with his morning coffee turning to acid in his stomach. He nods his head when you all come in, and a weird smile that's probably just dyspepsia and nerves plays across his lips. He nods again, then points a trifle shyly at the stainless steel table, just a regular examination table, with a little shrug as if to say, "We wish it could be nicer, but you know how times are." The two guards each take an arm as you slide your backside onto the paper covering. They're helping you, really, making sure your trembling legs don't prompt an embarrassing collapse. They're helping, but their grips are very, very firm. You lift your legs onto the table and let them ease you down onto your back. They begin to secure the straps. Until this point, it could be any other visit to the prison doctor, except no one's talking. Not surprising, really. There's not much to say. Your condition has already been diagnosed, and it's terminal, dangerous, useless bastard, trouble, poor self-control, inconvenient to house and expensive to feed. The combination of symptoms has added up. The cure has been decided. It's no use telling them you're innocent. You've done that for years, done it in every way possible. It hasn't changed a thing. The appeals, the couple of magazine articles, "Burying Our Mistakes," read one headline, appropriate to both prisons and hospitals, changed nothing in the end. The little kid in you, the part which had believed that if you cried hard enough someone would put it right, is gone now, rubbed out as efficiently and completely as the rest of you soon will be. Some corporate officer is standing in the doorway, a shark-skin gray shadow. You turn to watch him, but Jenkel's hip is in the way. A brief splash of something cold in the crook of your elbow brings your eyes back to the doctor's pinched face. Alcohol? For what? They're swabbing your arm so you don't get an infection. A little prison humor, perhaps. More subtle than you would have expected. You feel something sharp slide through the skin, nosing for your vein. But something goes wrong. The doctor curses quietly, just a hint of panic underneath, and withdraws the needle. Then probes for the vein again, once, twice, 3 more times without success. It hurts, like someone running a sewing machine up your arm. You feel something welling up in your chest that might be either a laugh or a long, bubbling scream. You choke it down, of course. God forbid you should make a spectacle of yourself. They're only going to kill you. Your skin has gone clammy all over. The fluorescents shimmer and swim as the spike of steel at last slides into its proper place, and the doctor tapes it down. The other guard, Simmons, or whatever his name is, leans over and tightens the strap so you don't jerk the needle free. They begin on the next needle. There is something bewildering about this. It's the end of the world, but the people around you are acting as though they were performing some workaday job. Only the tiny beads of sweat on the doctor's upper lip and frowning forehead suggest otherwise. When you have been trussed and lanced successfully, the gray suit in the corner of your vision moves forward. You haven't seen his face before, and you briefly wonder where he fits in the corporate hierarchy. Is he an overwarden or an underwarden? Then you realize what kind of nonsense you're wasting your last moments on, and feel a surge of dizzy disgust. This square-jawed white man mouths some suitably mournful platitudes, then lifts a folder and reads out the Penal Corporation's indemnification, followed by their legal mandate to pump you full of sodium pentothal, and then potassium chloride, until your heart stops beating and your brain box goes flatline. They used to send a third fatal chemical down the pipe, too, but the accountants decided that was gilding the lily. The doctor has started the saline drip. Although you feel nothing in your arm except the discomfort of the needle and some stinging from the failed attempts. "Do you understand, son?" the square-jawed white man asks you. "Sure," you want to snarl. "You understand better than he knows. You understand that they're just throwing out the trash and then recycling the empties. You'll be more used to society as ram-plugged hydroponic fertilizer than you ever were as a mouth to feed in an expensive privatized cell." You want to snarl, but you don't. For now, looking into the pale blue eyes of this man, you realize in a way you haven't yet that you're really going to die. No one is going to jump up from behind the sofa and tell you it was just a joke. It's not a Netflix either. No group of hired mercenaries is going to blow down the prison doors and set you free. In a moment, the doctor is going to push that button, and that bottle of clear liquid. They would be clear liquids, wouldn't they? Colorless, just like this square-jawed, flat-eyed white man they've sent to read your death warrant. That bottle is going to start to bleed into the mainline. And then you're going to die. You try to speak, but you can't. The cold has you shivering. Jenkel pulls the thin hospital blanket up to your chest, careful not to disturb the transparent tube fanged into your arm like a long glass snake. You nod instead. By God, you're not stupid. You understand the laws and how they work. If it hadn't been one, it would have been another. They make those laws to keep people like you away from what people like them have. So you nod, trying to say what your dry tongue and constricted throat cannot. I know why you want me dead. I don't need any more explanation than that. The man in the gray suit smiles, a tight, curved line, as though he recognizes the look in your eyes. He nods to the doctor just once, and then tucks his folder under his arm and heads for the door, disappearing out of your sight beyond the curving line of Jenkel's blue trousers. You have just met the Angel of Death. He was a stranger. He is always a stranger. Jenkel gives your arm a squeeze, which means the doctor has turned the tap on the second line. But you don't look up to meet the guard's eye. You don't want your last sight on earth to be him. He's nobody, just a man who guarded your cage. A decent guy for a keeper in a human zoo, maybe, but no more than that. A short time passes, thick, sluggish time that nevertheless hurries. Your gaze slides up toward the fluorescent lights, and they shimmer even more broadly than before. There are little fractures of color around the edges. Your eyes, you realize, are filling with tears. At the same time, the room is growing warmer. You can feel your skin growing looser, your muscles unkinking. This isn't so bad, but you're never coming back. Your heart speeds. They're pushing you out into the darkness. One passenger too many on the big ship, and you've drawn the short straw. Some kind of animal panic races through you, and for a moment you strain against your bonds, or try to. But the whole thing is too far gone. A muscle twitches in your chest. That's all. A slow contraction like the early stages of labor. Like birth. Wrong way. Wrong way. You're going out. Not coming in. The blackness is tugging you remorselessly, pulling you down, eroding your resistance. You're hanging by your fingernails over an ocean of warm velvet. And it would be so easy, so easy, so easy to let go. But there's something underneath all that softness, something harsh and final, and oh, so terrifyingly lonely. Gone. The light almost gone. Just a fast disappearing smear. Gone. The light gone. A soundless scream. A spark sizzling through a final instant before being swallowed by the cold darkness. Oh, God, I don't want to. He was still shivering half an hour later.
You're so scanny, Gardner. Lethal injection. Jesus, you're a scan master.
Orlando looked up, trying to focus. The dark saloon was full of shadows and trailing mist, but his friend's broad silhouette was hard to mistake. Fredericks slipped into one of the crooked high-backed chairs and perused the menu of experiences that flickered across the black tabletop, an ever-changing abstract spiderweb of frost-white letters. He made a face of exaggerated disgust. The defiant lift to his shoulders made his sim appear even more chesty and muscle-bound than usual.
What is it with you and these fringe trips, Gardner?
Orlando could never figure why Fredericks liked bodybuilder sims. Maybe in RL he was a scrawny little guy. It was impossible to know, since Orlando had never seen his friend in the flesh. And at this point, it would be embarrassing even to ask. Besides, Orlando himself was not innocent of image tampering. The sim he was wearing was, as usual, a well-crafted product, although not particularly handsome or physically impressive.
The death rides? I just like them.
He was having some difficulty composing his thoughts. Legacy of that last slide down into nothingness. They interest me.
Yeah, well, I think they're morbid major.
A line of tiny skeletons conga danced across the tabletop in front of Fredericks, each one dressed in full Carmen Miranda drag. They strutted, hip-shook, then vanished in a sequence of pops as they tumbled over the edge. The place was full of the things, miniature skeletons playing fireman's pole on the swizzle sticks and skating on the ice trays, an entire skeletal army performing acrobatics on the vast chandelier, some in tiny Stetsons and chaps, even rode on the bats flittering in the shadows beneath the high ceiling. The decor of the Last Chance Saloon traded heavily on its virtual proximity to Terminal Row. Most of its habitués, however, preferred the mock gothic of the club to the more unpleasant and more realistic experiences on sale at the next site over.
You did the airplane crash with me,
Orlando pointed out. Fredericks snorted.
Yeah, once. You've been on that one so many times they probably have your seat permanently reserved.
His broad sim face flattened out for a moment, as though somewhere the real Fredericks had withdrawn from the system. But it was only his software's inability to show sullenness. Unfortunate, since Fredericks was prone to it.
That was the worst. I thought I was really going to die. I thought my heart was going to stop. How can you do that kind of shit, Gardner?
You get used to it. But he hadn't really. And that was part of the problem. In the conversational lull that followed, the vast doors at one side of the saloon creaked open, and a painfully cold wind swirled through the room. Orlando absently turned down his susceptibility. Fredericks, using a less expensive interface, didn't even notice. Something with glowing red eyes loomed in the open doorway, confettied with whirling snow. A few of the patrons nearest the door laughed. One very feminine sim screamed.
"Someone told me that they record those simulations from real people dying,"
said Fredericks abruptly.
"They take 'em right off real people's interface rigs."
"Nah," Orlando shook his head. "They're just good gear. Well written." He watched as the red-eyed thing grabbed the screaming woman and dragged her off into the snowy night. The doors creaked shut again. What, they just sent somebody up fitted with a giga-expensive top-of-the-line tele-neural recording rig, and it just happens to be running when a plane does a Manila? That's like a zillion-to-one chance, Federico, and you wouldn't be getting it in some net arcade.
not to mention the fact that you can't record that kind of experience and play it back anyway. Not like that. I've checked up on it, man. Real people recordings are just a jumble of stuff, a real monster mix. You can't interpret somebody else's experience through a different brain. It doesn't work.
Yeah? Fredericks did not sound entirely convinced, but he lacked Orlando's obsessive interest in VR in the net and generally didn't dispute him about such things.
Anyway, that's not what I wanted to talk to you about.
Orlando leaned back.
We've got more important things to deal with, and we need to talk in private. This place is dead anyway. Let's go to my cot.
Yeah, this place is dead.
Fredericks giggled as two finger-length skeletons skittered across the table, playing frisbee with a bottle cap. Orlando frowned.
That's not what I meant.
Orlando's electronic cottage was in Park Corner, an upscale but bohemian section of the inner district, inhabited mostly by well-to-do university students. His home base in the virtual world was an almost stereotypical version of a boy's bedroom, the kind of room Orlando would have liked to have at home, but couldn't. A wall-wide screen showed a constant live video feed from the MBC project, a vast swirling desert of orange. Orlando's visitors had to squint to see the armies of little constructor robots moving through the haze of Martian dust. On the far wall, a broad window looked down on the simulation of a late Cretaceous waterhole. It was pretty lively for over-the-counter wallpaper. At the moment, a young Tyrannosaurus was messily devouring a duck-billed Hadrosaurus. The interior was modeled on the Scandinavian-style beach house Orlando's parents had rented when he was a child. He had been very impressed with the multitude of nooks, stairs, and partially hidden alcoves, and if anything, he had exaggerated the labyrinthine effect in his virtual reconstruction. Strewn everywhere about the multi-level space were souvenirs of his, and especially Thargor's, net-gaming prowess. One corner of the room held a pyramid of simulated glass cases, each one containing a replica of the head of a vanquished enemy, rendered directly from a snapshot dump of the foe's final seconds whenever possible. At the summit of the pyramid, Dieter Cabo's black elf prince held pride of place, cross-eyed from the sword stroke that had just split his narrow skull. That battle had lasted 3 days, and had almost caused Orlando to fail his biology midterm, but it had been worth it. People in the Middle Country still spoke of the epic struggle with awe and envy. Various other objects had niches of their own. There were cages of wrestling homunculi, the remnants of another enemy's misfired spell, the Aselfian orb that Thargor had pulled from the brow of a dying god, even the skeletal hand of the wizard Drera Jar. Thargor had not removed that himself, but he had filched it from a certain merchant of oddities only moments before its original and somewhat irritated owner arrived to reclaim it. Up the length of the staircase, in place of a banister, stretched the body of the unpleasant worm of Morsin Keep, an hour wrestling with a thing in the keep's brackish moat, and a certain respect for anything so stupid and yet so determined had earned it a place in his collection. Besides, he thought it looked pretty detailed stretched out beside the stairs.
"I didn't think you'd want to talk about it."
Fredericks slid down onto the broad black leather couch.
"I figured you'd be really upset."
"I am upset. But there's more to this than Thargor getting killed. Much more."
Fredericks squinted. Orlando didn't know what his friend looked like in RL, but he was pretty sure he wore glasses.
"What does that mean, more to this? You impacted. Thargor got killed. What did I miss?"
"You missed a lot. Come on, Fredericks. Have you ever seen me do something like that? Someone hacked my venture. Somebody got at me."
He did his best to explain the arresting vision of the Golden City, but found it was almost impossible to find words that would explain how vibrantly, unbelievably real it had been.
"It was like if I tore a hole in that window."
He gestured to the Cretaceous gnashing and squawking on the far side of simulated glass.
"And you could see the real world behind it. Not a video picture of the real world, not even with the best resolution you can imagine, but the real, actual world. But it was some place I've never seen. I don't think it's a place on Earth."
"You think Morpher did it? Or maybe Dieter? He was really scorched over the black elf thing."
"Don't you get it? Nobody we know could do this. I don't know if the government or Critipong's top-level research lab could do it."
Orlando began to pace back and forth across the sunken room. He felt hemmed in. He made a quick gesture, and the floor space expanded, moving the walls and Frederick's couch several yards back.
"Hey!"
His friend sat up.
"Are you trying to tell me it was UFOs or something? Come on, Gardino. If someone was doing something that weird on the net, it would be in the news or something."
Orlando paused, then shouted, "Beazle!" A door opened in the floor, and a small something with rolling eyes and too many legs leaped out and hurried toward him. It tumbled to a stop by his feet, then tugged itself into an untidy heap and said in a raspy Brooklyn accent,
"Yeah, boss?
Do a news search for me on the phenomenon I just described, or any other major net anomalies, and find me the record of the final 15 minutes of my last Thargor game."
"Doing it now, boss."
Another door opened in the floor, and Beazle popped into it. There was a cartoon soundtrack noise of pots and pans crashing and things falling. Then the creature reappeared, limbs flailing, dragging a small black square as though it were the anchor off a luxury liner.
"Phew!"
the agent panted.
"Lot of news to check, boss. Want to look at this while I'm searching? It's the game record."
Orlando took the small square and stretched. It grew to the size of a beach towel and hung unsupported in space. He started to tilt it toward Frederick's, then smiled. Even with as much time as he spent on the net, he could still fall into a bit of RL thinking when he was in a hurry. VR didn't work that way. If Frederick's wanted to see the sample, he'd see it no matter where he was sitting. But now he was thinking about angles. He rapped on the square with his finger, and it expanded into the third dimension.
"Run it, Beazle,"
he said.
"Give me a viewpoint from somewhere outside the characters."
There was a moment's pause as the processors reconfigured the data. Then the black cube was illuminated by the light of a torch flickering on two figures.
"Diamonds of imperial weight,"
he heard himself saying in his deepened Thargor voice.
50, by the gods!"
"Yes. Now shut your mouth."
Orlando surveyed the scene critically. It was strange to stand on the outside of Thargor like this, as though the barbarian were only a character in a net flick.
"Too early. I haven't even dug into the tomb yet. Forward 10 minutes.
Now he could see his alter ego pushing through the upside-down thicket of roots, torch in one hand, rune sword in the other. Suddenly, Thargor stood straight. Life Reaper lifted as if to ward off a blow.
"That's it,"
said Orlando.
"That's when I saw it. Beazle, give me POV so I can see the wall directly in front of Thargor."
The image blurred. An instant later, the viewpoint had moved to a place just behind the mercenary's right shoulder. The wall was fully visible, including the place where the burning crevice had appeared. Except it hadn't appeared.
"What? This is scanny. Freeze it, Beazle."
Orlando slowly rotated the shape, looking at the wall from different sides. His stomach lurched.
"I don't believe this.
I don't see anything," said Fredericks.
"Thanks for pointing that out."
Orlando made his agent change the viewpoint several times. He and Fredericks even froze the recorded simulation and entered it. But there was nothing out of the ordinary. Thargor was not reacting to anything visible.
"Shit."
Orlando led his friend back out of the recording.
"Let it run."
They watched in silence as Thargor leaned forward to stare at the still unbroken wall. Then they heard Fredericks, as Piflet the thief, shouting,
"There is something coming into the chamber! The tomb's guardian! Thargor!"
"It didn't happen that fast, did it?"
Frederick sounded a little uncertain, but Orlando felt a surge of relief. He wasn't crazy after all.
"It sure as hell didn't. Look, here it comes."
He pointed to the lich shambling from the edge of the cube. Battle axe flailing.
"The whole sequence takes 10 seconds, maybe, according to this. But you know it was longer than that, right?"
"Yeah. I'm pretty sure you were staring at that wall for a much longer time. I thought you'd had to break your connection, or the link had gone dead or something."
Orlando snapped his fingers, and the cube vanished.
"Beazle, investigate that section of the game record for editing or tampering of any kind. Check runtime discrepancies against the game clock, and send a copy to the Table of Judgment, noted as a possible improper character death."
The spidery agent popped into the room from out of nowhere and sighed deeply.
"Jeez, boss! Anything else you want me to do? I got the first download of search records.
File 'em. I'll look at them later. Anything seriously interesting? Anything right on the nose?
Golden cities and or super-real phenomena in virtual media? Not really, but I'm giving you everything I can find that's even a little warm.
Good. Something was tugging at the back of Orlando's mind. A memory of the strange metropolis, its shining pyramids and towers of folded amber and gold leaf. At first it had seemed a personal vision, a gift for him alone. Was he ready to give up on that possibility? I changed my mind about the Table of Judgment. I don't want them involved. Not yet, anyway. Beazle grunted.
Whatever. Now, if you don't mind, I got work to do.
The creature produced a cigar from out of the air, stuck it in one corner of its wide, wobbly mouth, then exited through a wall, ostentatiously blowing cartoon smoke rings.
You've got to get another agent, said Fredericks. That one's scanny, and you've had it for years. That's why we work so well together.
Orlando crossed his legs Indian style and floated half a yard up into the air. The whole point of having an agent is that you don't need to worry about commands and stuff. Beazle knows what I mean when I say something.
Fredericks laughed. Beazlebug, that's so woofy.
Orlando glowered. I named it when I was a kid. Come on, we've got some weird stuff happening. Chi scene major sample. Are you going to help me think, or are you going to sit there making stupid comments?
Sit here making stupid comments?
Thought so. Christabel's daddy and his friend Ron, but Christabel had to call him Captain Parkins, were sitting in the living room having a couple of jars. That's what they called it when they drank her father's scotch and talked. But when her daddy drank some by himself or with Mommy, it wasn't called that. One of those grown-up things. She was wearing her storybook sunglasses, but she was having trouble paying attention to the story because she was also listening to the men. It was a treat for her daddy to be home in the daytime, even on a Saturday, and she liked to be in the room he was in, even if he was talking to Captain Parkins, who had a silly mustache that looked like it belonged to a walrus. The two men were watching some football players on the wall screen.
"It's a shame about that Gamecock kid, whatever his name was," her daddy said. "His poor parents. Hey, football's a dangerous game."
Captain Parkins paused to drink. She couldn't see him because she was looking at Sleeping Beauty on the storybook sunglasses, but she knew the sounds he made swallowing, and she also knew his mustache would be getting wet. She smiled to herself.
"Most of them are ghetto kids. They'd never get out otherwise. It's a calculated risk, like joining the military."
He laughed his loud ha-ha-ha laugh.
"Yeah, but still, it's a hell of a way to go. What do you expect when you've got kids who are 400 pounds of muscle and can run like a sprinter? One of them hits you and pow! Even with that new body armor, it's a wonder there aren't more deaths."
"I know what you mean," her daddy said. "It's like they're breeding them special in the inner city. Extra big, extra fast. Like they're a whole different species."
"I was in the National Guard during the St. Louis riots," said Captain Parkins.
There was something cold in his voice that made Christabel squirm even across the room.
"They are a whole different species. Well, I wish the heels would start recruiting a few more of them," her daddy said, laughing. "We could use some muscle on our defensive line."
Christabel got bored with listening to them talk about sports. The only thing she liked were the names of the teams. Tar Heels, Blue Devils, Demon Deacons. They might have been from a fairy tale. The picture of the handsome prince had been frozen for a little while. She touched the earpiece and let it run. He was sliding through a forest of bushes covered with thorns. Big, long, sharp ones. Even though she'd seen the story many times, she still worried that he might get caught on one of them and really be hurt. He made his way through the ring of thorns, wondering what might be hidden inside, the voice said in her earplug. She was only wearing one so she could hear Daddy and his friend talk, so the voice was quiet. "Now you read the next part," it told her. Christabel squinted at the lines of print that appeared beneath the thorns as though written on a cloud of mist.
Several times he was snagged on the thorny branches," she read, "and once he was caught fast so that he feared he might never escape. But he carefully pulled his shirt and cloak free. His clothes were torn, but he was not hurt."
"Christabel, honey, could you read a little more quietly?" her daddy called. "Ron doesn't know how that one ends. You'll spoil it for him."
"Funny.
Very funny, said Captain Parkins.
Sorry, Daddy.
She read on, whispering as the prince broke through a wall of cobwebs and found himself at the gate of Sleeping Beauty's castle.
Oh, I've got a story about our little old friend, said Captain Parkins. Caught him yesterday mucking about in the records for the PX. You'd think with the way he goes through food that he was trying to double his meals quota, but he was just trying to increase his allowance of a certain key product. Let me guess. Plant food? Fertilizer? Even stranger. And considering he hasn't been out of that place in 30 years, downright bizarre.
Christabel stopped listening, because there were new words forming across the bottom of the Sleeping Beauty story. They were bigger than the others, and one of them was her name. Help me, Christabel. It read, Secret, don't tell anyone. As the word secret appeared, she realized she was reading out loud. She stopped, alarmed. But Captain Parkins was still talking to her daddy, and they hadn't heard her.
I told the PX to refuse the order unless he could give them an acceptable explanation, of course. And I also asked them to reroute any unusual requests to me. Now, what do you think he's after? Making a bomb? Spring cleaning?
Like you said, he hasn't been out in decades.
No, I think he's just senile. But we'll keep an eye on him. Maybe I should drop by and check up, after I've shaken this cold. I'm sure that place incubates viruses like nobody's business.
Christabel was still reading the words in her storybook sunglasses, but she was reading them silently now, and holding her breath, too, because it was such a strange secret to have right next to her daddy. And bring them to me. Please hurry. Don't tell anyone. Secret. The regular words came back. But Christabel didn't want to read about Sleeping Beauty anymore. She took off her sunglasses. But before she could stand up, her mother appeared in the living room door.
Well, you boys look comfortable, she said. I thought you were sick, Mike.
Nothing that a little football and a few judicious doses of single malt won't clear up right smart.
Christabel stood up and turned off the sunglasses, in case they started talking out loud and gave the secret away.
Mom, can I go out? Just for a minute?
No, honey. I've just put lunch on the table. Have something to eat first, then you can go. Ron, will you join us?
Captain Parkins shifted in his chair and put his empty glass down on the coffee table.
I'd be delighted, ma'am.
Christabel's mother smiled.
If you call me ma'am again, I'll be forced to poison your food.
It'd still be an improvement over what I get at home.
Her mother laughed and led the men into the kitchen. Christabel was worried. The message had said hurry, but once lunch was on the table, no one went anywhere. That was the rule, and Christabel always obeyed the rules. Well, almost always. She stood up, a stalk of celery in her hand.
Can I go out now?
If it's okay with your father.
Her daddy looked her up and down like he was suspicious. For a moment she was scared, but then she saw he was playing a joke on her.
And where are you taking that celery, young lady?
I like to eat it when I'm walking.
She took a bite to show him.
I like to make it crunch when I walk. So it sounds like a monster going crunch, 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 stepping on buildings.
All the grown-ups laughed.
Kids, said Captain Parkins. Okay, then. But be back before dark.
I promise.
She scurried out of the dining room and took her coat down off the peg. But instead of heading directly for the front door, she went quietly down the hall toward the bathroom and opened the cabinet under the sink. When she had filled her pockets, she moved as silently as she could back to the door.
I'm going now,
she shouted.
Be careful, little monster,
her mother called back. Red and brown leaves were skittering across the front lawn. Christabel hurried to the corner. After peeking back to make sure no one was watching, she turned toward Mr. Sellers' house. Nobody answered when she knocked. After a few minutes, she let herself in, even though it felt funny, like being a robber or something. The wet, hot air pressed in all around her, so thick it seemed like something alive. Mr. Sellers was sitting in his chair, but his head was way back, and his eyes were closed. For a moment she was sure he was dead, and was getting ready to be really scared, but then one eye opened, like a turtle's eye, really slow, and he looked at her. His tongue came out, too, and he licked his ragged lips and tried to talk, but he couldn't make any sounds come out. He held his hand up toward her. It was shaking. At first, she thought he wanted her to take it,
but then she saw that he was pointing at her bulging pockets.
"Yes, I brought some," she said. "Are you okay?"
He moved his hand again, almost a little angry this time. She pulled the bars of her mother's face soap out of her coat and piled them in his lap. He began scratching at one of the bars with his fingers, but he was having trouble getting the wrapping off.
"Let me do it."
She took the bar out of his lap and unpeeled it. When it lay in her hand, white and shiny, he pointed to a plate sitting on the table beside him. On the plate was a very old cheese. It was all dry and cracked, and a knife.
"You want some food?"
she asked. Mr. Sellers shook his head and picked up the knife. He almost dropped it. His hands were shaking so much, but then he held it out to Christabel. He wanted her to cut the soap. She sawed away at the slippery bar for some time. She had done soap carving in class, but it wasn't easy. This time she concentrated very hard, and at last she managed to cut off a piece as wide as two of her fingers side by side. Mr. Sellers reached out a hand like a melted bird claw and took it from her, then popped it in his mouth and slowly began to chew.
"Yuck!"
she said.
"That's bad for you."
Mr. Sellers smiled for the first time. Little white bubbles were in the corner of his mouth. He took the soap and the knife from her and began to cut himself more pieces. When he had swallowed the first and was about to put the second in his mouth, he smiled again and said, "Go get changed." His voice was weak, but at least he sounded like the Mr. Sellers she knew. When she returned wearing the terry cloth bathrobe, he had finished the whole first bar and had begun to cut up another.
"Thank you, Christabel," he said. "Zinc peroxide. Just what the doctor ordered. I've been very busy, and I haven't been getting my vitamins and minerals."
"People don't eat soap for vitamins," she said indignantly.
But she wasn't completely sure, because since she'd been in school, she'd been getting her vitamins in a skin patch. And anyway, maybe old people had a different kind of vitamins.
"I do," the old man said, "and I was very sick until you got here."
"But you're better now?"
"Much better. But you should never eat any. It's just for special old men."
He wiped a smear of white from his lower lip.
"I've been working very, very hard, little Christabel. People to see, things to do."
Which was a silly joke, she knew, because he never went anywhere or saw anyone but her and the man who delivered his food. He'd told her that. His smile went away, and his eyes started to close. After a moment, he opened them again, but he looked very tired.
"And now that you've rescued me, perhaps you'd better head back home. I'm sure you had to make up some story about where you were going. I feel guilty enough about having you lie to your parents without getting you in trouble by keeping you too long."
"How did you talk to me in my storybook sunglasses?"
"Oh, just a little trick I learned when I was a young cadet."
His head wobbled a little.
"I think I need to sleep now, my friend. Can you let yourself out?"
She sat up straight.
"I always let myself out."
"So you do. So you do."
He raised his hand as if he were waving to her. His eyes closed again. When Christabel had changed back into her clothes, they were damp, so she would have to walk around for a while before she went home, Mr. Sellers was asleep in his chair. She looked at him carefully to make sure he wasn't sick again, but he was a much pinker color than he'd been when she arrived. She cut him off a few more pieces of soap, just in case he felt weak when he woke up again, then tucked his blanket close around his long, thin neck.
"It's so difficult," he said suddenly. She jumped back, afraid she'd woken him up,
but his eyes did not open, and his voice was whispery and hard to understand.
"Everything must be hidden in plain sight. But I despair sometimes. I can only speak to them in whispers, half-truths, bits of tattered poetry. I know how the oracle felt."
He mumbled a bit more, but she couldn't hear the words. When he got quiet and didn't say anything more, she patted his thin hand and left. A cloud of mist followed her out the front door. The wind on her wet clothing made her shiver. An oracle was a kind of bird, wasn't it? So was Mr. Sellers dreaming about the days when he used to be an airman? The leaves came swirling down the sidewalk past her, skipping and tumbling like circus acrobats. His arms were pinioned. He was being jostled and pushed down a dark trail, sheer cliff faces looming on either side.
He was being carried away, he knew, down into blackness and nothingness. Something important lay behind him, something that he dared not lose. But every moment the hands that clutched him, the shadowy forms on either side, were carrying him farther and farther away from it. He tried to turn and felt a sharp pain in his arm, as though someone held a needle-bladed dagger against the flesh. The deeper darkness of the mountain pass was reaching out to enfold him. He struggled, ignoring the piercing agony in his arms, and at last managed to pull free enough to turn his head. In the cleft behind him, nestled between the rocky slopes, but miles away, lay a field of sparkling golden light. As he looked out from shadow, it burned in the distance like a prairie fire. The city, the place where he would find the thing he had hungered for so long. The hands seized him and turned him back around, then shoved him forward. He still could not see who held him, but he knew that they were dragging him down into shadow, into emptiness, into a place where even the memory of the golden city at last would fade. He fought against his captors, but he was held fast. His dream, his one hope, was receding. He was being carried down helplessly into a black void.
"Orlando! Orlando! You're having a bad dream. Wake up!"
He struggled upward toward the voice. His arms hurt.
They had him. He had to fight.
He opened his eyes. His mother's face hovered over him, shining faintly in the light from the window like a three-quarter moon.
"Look what you've done."
Concern fought with annoyance in her voice. Concern won, but just barely.
"You've knocked all your things over. I was having a bad dream." "As if I couldn't tell. It's that net, all day long.
No wonder you have nightmares." She sighed, then bent and began picking things up. A little anger pierced his lingering chill.
"You think the net is the only reason I have nightmares?"
She paused, a wad of dermal patches filling her palm like fallen leaves.
"No,"
she said. Her voice was tight.
"No, of course I don't."
She put the patches on his bedside table and bent to pick up the other things he had knocked over.
"But I still think it can't be good for you to spend so much time plugged into that machine."
Orlando laughed. It was an angry laugh, and he meant it to be. "Well, everybody needs a hobby, Vivian." She pursed her lips, even though it had been his parents' idea that he should call them by their first names, not his.
"Don't be bitter, Orlando."
"I'm not." And he wasn't really, he realized. Not like sometimes, but he was angry and frightened, and he wasn't quite sure why. Something to do with the nightmare, the details of which were already beginning to evaporate, a feeling that something else was also slipping away from him. He took a breath. "I'm sorry. It was a scary dream." She set his IV stand back up straight. He had tipped it over against the wall with his thrashing, and checked to make sure the needle was still in place and secured.
"Dr. Vaughn says we can stop using this at the end of the week. That will be nice, won't it?"
It was her way of apologizing. He tried to accept it in good grace.
"Yeah, that'll be nice,"
he yawned.
"I'll go back to sleep. Sorry if I made a lot of noise."
She pulled the blanket back up to his chest. For a moment she rested her cool hand against his cheek.
I was just worried. No more bad dreams now. Promise?"
He slid down, found the remote, and tilted the upper part of the bed to a more comfortable angle.
"Okay, Vivian. Good night."
"Good night, Orlando." She hesitated for a moment, then leaned to kiss him before she went out. For a moment he considered turning on his nightlight to read, then decided against it, knowing that his mother had heard his distress from the other room, made the darkness a little more comfortable than usual, and he had things to think about. The city, for one thing, that preposterous place of which no record seemed to remain in the Middle Country. It had invaded his dreams, just as it had invaded Thargor's world. Why did something which was probably no more than a bit of signal interference, or at most a hacker's prank, seem so important? He had given up believing in far more practical types of miracles long ago. So what could this mirage possibly mean for him? Did it signify anything at all, or was it only a freak occurrence, acting now as a magnet for his fear and largely abandoned hope? The house was quiet. Nothing short of an explosion would wake his father, and by now his mother would have slid back down into her own shallower and more restless slumber. Orlando was alone in the darkness with his thoughts. Chapter 11. Inside the Beast. Netfeed, music. Christ plays for lucky few. Visual, close-up of dog's head. V.O. Johann Sebastian Christ made a surprise appearance on a local net show in his adopted hometown of New Orleans. Visual, dog head, human hands. The first time the reclusive singer has been seen since the death of three members of his musical group, Blonde Bitch, in a stage accident last year. Visual, man dancing in dog mask. Flaming stage shown on wall screen in background. Christ performed three songs for the astonished studio audience, accompanying himself with a playback of the accident. Weenie turned, frantically scanning the crowd that filled the terraces around the bottomless well. Habu hadn't replied, but perhaps there was something wrong with his equipment. Perhaps he'd just gone offline, and there was something wrong with her equipment, which still registered a guest on her line. She prayed it was that simple. The crush was insubstantial, but still overwhelming. Laughing businessmen in smoothly tailored, blade-hard bodies bumped her aside as they passed, their first-class rigs and paid-up accounts generating an invisible but very real barrier between them and the hoi polloi. A few obvious tourists in rudimentary virtual forms moved aimlessly, overwhelmed as the swirling traffic bounced them from one edge of the walkway to the other. Smaller forms, servitor creatures and agents, darted in and out of the throng, running errands for their masters. As far as Reenie could tell, Habu was not one of them. But her search was made more difficult by the unexceptional quality of the sim he had been wearing. There were at least 24 quite similar figures within a short distance of her, gawking at the scenery while trying to stay out of the way of the big spenders. Even if he were close by, without audio contact it was impossible to locate him quickly, and Reenie knew she had only moments before Strimbello arrived. She needed to move, to get going, but where? Even if she ran far and fast, she couldn't hope to hide for very long within Mr. J's from someone who was connected to the club. Besides, the fat man had announced that he knew her, knew who she truly was. Even now, the club's management might be accessing her index, contacting the Polly to get her fired. Who could guess? But she could not afford those worries right now. She had to find Habu. Had he simply gone offline, disgusted by the yellow room's grotesque floor show? He might even now be loosening his straps in the harness room, waiting for her to return. But what if he hadn't? A startled eddy of reaction passed over the faces around her. Most of the terrace crowd turned toward the door of the yellow room. Reenie turned too. Something huge had appeared in the passage behind her, vast and round, wider than 4 or 5 normal sims and still growing. Its shaven head swiveled like the turret on a tank. Black eyes like machine-gun barrels raked the crowd, then locked on her. The thing that called itself Strimbello smiled. "There you are!" Reenie spun, took 2 swift steps, and flung herself over the rim of the well. Moving at top permissible speed, she dove downward through other, less hurried club patrons who floated like lazy fish. Her descent was still agonizingly slow. The well was a browsing device, not a thrill ride. But she did not intend to outrun the fat man. He almost undoubtedly knew Mr. J's far too well for that to work. She had simply moved out of his visual field for a moment, which she hoped would give her time to do something more effective. "Random," she commanded. The well and its thousands of sims bobbing like champagne bubbles blurred and vanished, replaced a moment later by another crush of bodies. All naked this time, although some bore attributes she had never seen on a living human form. The light was directionless and low, the close-leaning walls velvety folds of uterine red. Throbbing music made her earplugs almost bounce. A sim face, frighteningly imprecise, looked up from the nearest coil of forms. A hand snaked free and reached out to her, beckoning. "Oh no," she murmured. How many of these shapes were minors, children like Stephen? Admitted with a smirk by the management, and allowed to glut themselves on the filth of this place. How many disguised children had been present in the yellow room, for that matter? Nausea knotted her stomach. Random. A vast, flat-walled space opened before her, its farther end so distant as to be nearly invisible. Gas-flame blue letters appeared before her in a script she did not recognize, while a voice intoned words into her earplugs that were equally incomprehensible. An instant later, The whole picture shuddered as the translation software read her index and changed to English. "Choose now whether you wish a team game or an individual competition." She stood and stared as humanoid shapes snapped into existence just behind the blue-burning letters. They wore spiked helmets and shiny body armor. The eyes within the visors were only sparks. "You have opted for an individual competition," said the voice with a faint note of approval. "The game is creating your designated opponents now."
Random.
She moved through the rooms faster and faster, hoping to lay down so many kinks in her trail that even if they tried to pin her location directly, it would take Strimbello some time to find her. She jumped and found a pool, surrounded by lazily swaying palm trees. Bare-breasted mermaids lounged on the rocks beside it, combing their hair as they swayed to languid steel guitar music. She jumped. A long table with one empty seat. The dozen men waiting there all wore robes. Most also wore beards. One turned as she popped in, smiled, and cried, "Seat yourself, Lord!" She jumped again, and kept jumping. A room full of blackness, with stars gleaming distantly up where the roof should be, and red-lit crevices in the floor. Somebody or something was groaning. 1,000 men with smooth heads like crash dummies, all dressed in identical coveralls, sitting on benches in 2 long rows, slapping each other. A jungle full of shadows and eyes and bright, colorful birds. A woman in a torn blouse was tied to a tree. Oily red blossoms were piled around her feet. A cowboy saloon. The bad guys wore nothing but spurs. A ship's rocking cabin. Oil lamps swinging. Tankards waiting in the gimbals. A glittering ballroom where all the women's faces were hidden behind animal masks. A medieval inn. The fire burned high and something howled outside the tiny windows. An empty park bench beside a streetlight. A blast of throbbing noise and blinding glare that might have been a dance club. A cave with wet walls, illuminated by strands like glowing spiderwebs that dangled from the ceiling. An old-fashioned phone box. The receiver was off the hook. A desert with walls. A casino that seemed to inhabit the gangster era of Hollywood movies. A desert without walls. A chamber with an oven-hot floor and all the furniture made of metal. A formal Korean garden. The bushes full of grunting, naked shapes. An open-air cafe beside the ruins of an ancient freeway. A terraced garden jutting like a theater balcony from the side of a tall cliff. Beside it, a vast waterfall thundered down into the gorge. Dizzy, almost ill from the speed of her transitions, Rini paused on the terrace. She closed her eyes until the blur of colors stopped, then opened them again. A few of the dozen or so guests sitting at tables along the edge of the garden looked up incuriously, then turned back to their conversations and the spectacle of the waterfall. "May I serve you?" A smiling, elderly Asian man had materialized beside her.
"I'm having trouble with my pad," she told him. "Can you connect me to your main switching center?"
"Done. Would you like a table while you conduct your business, Mr. Otepi?"
Damn. She had stopped in one of the high-rent zones of the club. Of course they would have run her index as soon as she entered. At least they hadn't grabbed her. Maybe Strimbello hadn't put out a general alert. Still, there was no sense pushing her luck.
"Not yet, thank you. I may have to leave. Just a privacy shield, please."
The man nodded and then vanished. A circle of blue light appeared around her at waist level, demonstrating that she was shielded. She could still hear the roar of the great waterfall and watch it smashing down the rocks into the canyon, where it disappeared into a cloud of white spume. She could even see the other guests and hear the occasional snatch of conversation over the water noises, but they, presumably, could no longer see or hear her. No time to waste. She forced herself to think calmly. She dared not leave unless Habu had already gone offline, but if he had, she would have no way of knowing. If she stayed, she felt sure Strimbello would find her sooner rather than later. He might not have sounded a general alarm. Even as an intruder, she was probably not very important in the larger scheme of things, but Strimbello himself, whether human or frighteningly realistic puppet, did not seem the type to give up easily. She would have to find a way to stay inside the system until she either located Habu or was forced to give up.
Phone connect.
A gray square appeared before her, as though someone had taken a sharp knife to reality. Rather, to imitation reality. She gave the number she wanted, then keyed in her pad's identification code.
The square remained gray, but a small glowing dot appeared in the lower corner to tell her she'd connected with the one-shot access bank she'd prepared for just such an emergency.
Carnival.
She whispered, but it was only reflex. If the privacy shield was legitimate, she could scream the code word until her lungs ached without anyone hearing. If it wasn't, everything she had done was already known to her pursuers. Nobody seemed to be watching. The access bank downloaded the new identity instantly. She was faintly disappointed that there was no sensation. Surely shape-changing, a hallowed and ancient magical art, should feel like something. But of course her shape hadn't changed. She still wore the nondescript sim in which she'd entered. And behind that was still Irene Sulawayo, teacher and part-time net bandit. Only her index was different. Mr. Otepi from Nigeria had vanished. Mr. Babutu from Uganda had taken his place. She dissolved the privacy shield and surveyed the massive waterfall, the elegant formal garden. Waiters, or things that looked like waiters, were skimming from table to table like water bugs. She could not hang about this place forever. In such a service-intensive sector of the club, she would quickly attract attention again, and she did not want her new identity linked in any way with the old one. Someone would notice eventually, of course. She had entered as Otepi, and at the end of some arbitrary accounting period, an expert system checking the records would notice that Otepi had never left. But that might be hours from now, or even days. A node with a turnover as large and constant as Mr. J's would have a hard time locating the other half of the discrepancy, and with luck she would be long gone by the time they did. With luck. With a word, she shifted back to the main lounge, where she would pass unnoticed more easily in the large and active crowd. She was tired, too, and eager for the chance to stay in one place for a few minutes. But what about Habu? He was so much less experienced. What effect would such stress be having on him if he wandered somewhere in this vast labyrinth, alone and frightened? The lounge was still full of glaring lights and long shadows, of voices and wild music. Weenie picked a bench sunk in the darkness at the base of one of the cyclopean walls and turned down the gain on her earplugs. It was hard to know where to start. There were so many rooms here, so many public spaces. She herself had been in dozens, and she was sure she had only scratched the surface, and she could not even guess at how many people might be in the club. Hundreds of thousands, perhaps. Mr. J's was not a physical space. The only limitation was the speed and power of the equipment that lay behind it. Her friend could be anywhere. Weenie turned to look at the revolving stage. The pale singer and her goblinish band were gone. Instead, a group of elephants, normal in every detail except for their straw hats, sunglasses, and strangely spiky instruments, and, of course, the delicate rosy pink of their baggy skins, were churning out slow, thumping dance music. She could feel the jar of the bass, even through her lowered earplugs. "Excuse me," one of the shiny-faced waiters hovered before her. "Nothing but rent for me," she told him. "I'm just resting."
"Fine with me, sir, I assure you. But I have a message for you."
"For me?" She leaned forward, staring. She felt her skin tingle. "That's not possible." He raised an eyebrow. His foot tapped on air. Weenie swallowed. "I mean, are you sure?" If the waiter was playing a game with her on behalf of her pursuers, he was doing a very convincing job. He practically seethed with impatience.
"Oh, squeeze! You are Mr. Babutu, aren't you? Because if you are, the rest of your party wants to meet you in the contemplation hall."
She recovered herself and thanked him. An instant later he was gone, a vanishing huff of silver. Of course it could be Habu, she thought. She had told him the names of both emergency identities, his and hers. Then again, it might just as easily be Strimbello or some other less broadly drawn functionaries, wishing to avoid a scene. Habu or Strimbello? It had to be one or the other. Mr. Babutu didn't really exist, so no one else would be looking for him. What choice did she have? She couldn't ignore the possibility of finding her friend. She picked Contemplation Hall out of the main menu and shifted. She thought she detected an almost infinitesimal hitch to the transfer, as though the system were experiencing unusually heavy usage, but it was hard to dispel the idea that the delay might mean she was going somewhere deep into the heart of the system, far from the metaphorical surface, deep inside the beast. The hall was a very striking conception, a sort of classical folly writ large.
Tall columns covered in flowering vines held up a huge circular dome, part of which had cracked and fallen away. White shards, some as large as a suburban house, glinted like bones along the base of the columns, tucked in threadbare blankets of moss. A bright blue sky, striped with wind-tattered clouds, showed through the hole in the dome and between the pillared arches on each side, as though the hall stood atop Mount Olympus itself. A few Sims, most of them far in the simulated distance, strolled about the wide, grassy space inside the ring of stone. She did not like the idea of leaving the outer edge and moving into the open space. But if the club's authorities had summoned her to this place, it wouldn't matter whether she tried to be inconspicuous or not. She shifted toward the center and turned to gaze around her, impressed with the completeness of the design. The stones of the massive folly seemed convincingly old, surfaces shot with cracks, columns surrounded and overgrown with vegetation. Rabbits and other small animals moved across the hummocky ground, and a pair of twittering birds were building a nest on one of the shards of the tumbled dome.
"Mr. Babutu?"
She whirled.
"Who are you?"
He was a tall, lantern-jawed man, made to seem even bigger by his baggy dark suit. He wore a tall and scuffed black top hat. A striped muffler hung loosely around his long neck.
"I'm Wicket."
He smiled broadly, tipping the hat. The shabbiness of his attire sat oddly with his quick, vigorous movements.
"Your friend Mr. Wande sent me. You got a message from him?"
Rini eyed him.
"Where is he?"
"With some of my mates. Come on, I'll take you to him."
He pulled something from inside his coat. If he saw Rini flinch at the movement, he showed no sign, but instead lifted the battered flute to his lips and played a few piping bars, something that she could not identify, but which seemed familiar as a nursery rhyme. A hole opened in the grass between them. Rini could see steps leading down. Why didn't he come himself? Wicket was already in the hole to his waist, which left the top of his black stovepipe at about Rini's eye level.
"Not feeling well, I think. He just asked me to fetch you. Said you might ask some questions. And to remind you about some game with string."
The string game? Habu's song?
Rini felt a weight of worry lift from her. No one but the bushman could know about that. Wicket's hat was just vanishing below the surface of the ground. She climbed down after him. The tunnels seemed to be something from a children's book, the home of some talking animal or other magical creature. Although within moments she and Wicket had moved far below what should have been the surface, the tunnel wall was pierced with small windows, and out of each she could see a scene of artificial beauty, riverlands, meadows, wind-groomed forests of oak and beech. Here and there, along the downward spiral of the steps, were small doors no higher than Rini's knee, each with a knocker and a minute keyhole. The urge to open one was powerful. The place was like some wonderful dollhouse. But she could not pause to look at anything. Although she herself was forced to keep one hand on the curving banister, Wicket, despite his long legs and broad shoulders, bounced down the stairway ahead of her at a rapid pace, still blowing on his flute. After a few minutes, he had vanished down the twisting stairwell. Only thin, musical echoes proved he was still in front of her. The stairwell wound down and down. Occasionally she thought she heard high-pitched voices from behind the doorways, or caught a glimpse of a bright eye peering out through a keyhole. Once she had to duck to avoid garroting herself on a laundry line which had been stretched right across the stairwell. Tiny calico dresses, none bigger than a slice of bread, slapped damply against her face. Down they went, still farther. More stairs, more doors, and the continuous trill of Wicket's elusive music. Rini felt the fairy-tale charm of the place beginning to pall. She craved a cigarette and a glass of beer. She ducked her head again to go under a low spot in the stairwell, and when she raised it, the light had changed. Before she could react, her foot met resistance too suddenly, giving her a jolt that would have been painful if her body were not in harness back at the poly. She had reached level ground. Stretching before her, as if in continuation of the storybook theme, was a mystery cave, the sort of place which jolly children discovered in jolly stories. It was long and low, all stone and soft earth. The ceiling was whiskery with roots, as though the cavern were some hollow space beneath forest earth, but tiny lights twinkled amid the tangle. The dirt floor was covered with piles of strange objects, some feathers and shiny beads and polished stones looked as though they had been collected and abandoned by animals or birds.
Others, like a pit filled with the limbs and heads of dolls, seemed purposeful and somewhat overwrought, a university art project on corrupted innocence. Other objects were just incomprehensible, featureless spheres and cubes and less recognizable geometric shapes scattered across the earthen floor. Some of these even seemed to glow with a faint light of their own. Wicket stood grinning before her. Even with his shoulders hunched, the top of his head loomed up among the twinkling fairy lights. He lifted his flute and played again, doing a slow dance as he did so. There was something incongruous about him, some oddness that Rini couldn't quite name. If he was a puppet, he was a work of real originality. Wicket stopped and repocketed the flute.
"You're slow," he said,
mockery in his deep voice.
"Come on, your friend's waiting."
He swept one hand to the side in a mock formal bow and stepped back. Behind him, on the far side of the long cavern, blocked from her sight until this moment, was the occluded glow of a campfire fenced by shadowy figures. Rini, again feeling the need for caution, moved forward. Her heart sped. Habu, or a sim that looked very much like his, was sitting in the midst of a group of much better defined figures, all men in tattered finery similar to Wicket's. With his sketchy features and rudimentary body details, the bushman seemed like nothing so much as a gingerbread man. More fairy tales. Rini was feeling a little punchy.
"Are you okay?"
she asked on private band.
"Habu, is that you?"
There was no reply, and for a moment she was certain she'd been tricked. Then the sim turned toward her, and a voice that, despite the distortion, was recognizably the bushman's, said,
"I am very glad my new friends have found you. I have been here such a long time. I was beginning to think you had left me behind. Talk to me. If you can hear me, just raise your hand."
The sim did not move, but sat regarding her with expressionless eyes.
"I wouldn't leave you,"
she said at last.
"How did you end up here?"
"We found him wandering around, lost and confused."
Wicket drew up his long legs as he seated himself beside the fire.
"My friends and me."
He pointed to the others in the circle.
"That's Brown Bread, Whistler, and Corduroy."
His companions were fat, thin, and thinner still. None were as tall as Wicket, but all seemed otherwise quite similar, full of nudges and restless energy.
"Thank you."
Rini turned her attention back to Habu.
"We must be going now. We're really quite late."
"Are you sure you wouldn't rather stay with us for a while?"
Wicket spread his hands before the flames.
"We don't get many visitors."
"I would like to. I'm very grateful for your help, but we are running up too much connect time."
Wicket raised his eyebrow as though she had said something faintly off color, but remained silent. Rini leaned forward and put her hand on Habu's shoulder, conscious that back at the poly she must be touching his real body. Despite the low quality of the force feedback, it certainly felt like her friend's narrow, bird-like physique.
"Come along. Let's go back."
"I do not know how." There was only a little sadness in his voice, but a great lassitude, as though he spoke from the edge of sleep.
"I have forgotten."
Rini cursed to herself and triggered the exit sequence for both of them. But as the cavern around her began to blur and fade, she could see that Habu was not shifting with her. She aborted the exit.
"Something's wrong," she said. "Something is holding him here."
"Perhaps you'll have to stay a little longer."
Wicket smiled.
"That'd be nice."
"Mr. Wande can tell us some more stories," said Brownbread,
pleasure evident on his round face.
"I wouldn't mind hearing the one about the lynx and the morning star again."
"Mr. Wande can't tell you any more stories,"
Weenie said sharply. Were these men simple-minded? Or were they just puppets, enacting some strange looped tableau that she and Habu had stumbled into?
"Mr. Wande has to leave. Our time is up. We cannot afford to stay longer."
Greyhound Finn Corduroy nodded his head gravely.
"Then you must call the masters. The masters see to all comings and goings. They will put you right."
Rini felt sure she knew who the masters were, and knew she did not want to explain her problem to the club's authorities.
"We can't. There are reasons."
The men around the fire frowned. If they were puppets, they might at any moment trigger some automatic message of breakdown to the club's troubleshooters. She needed time to figure out why Habu could not be removed from the net.
There is someone very bad pretending to be one of the masters. If the masters are summoned, then this bad one will find us. We cannot call them."
All the men nodded now. like superstitious savages in some Z-grade net flick.
"We'll help you, then," said Wicked enthusiastically. "We'll help you against the bad one."
He turned to his companions.
"The Colleen. The Colleen will know what to do for these fellows."
"That's right."
Whistler's lisp betrayed the origin of his name. He spoke slowly and wore a lopsided grin.
"She'll help, but she'll want something."
"Who's Colleen?"
Rini struggled with fear and impatience. Something was seriously wrong with her friend. The club authorities were searching for her, and Strimbello had said he knew who she really was. But instead of taking Habu and getting the hell out, she was being forced to participate in some kind of fairy tale scenario. She looked at the bushman. His sim sat motionless beside the fire, rigid as a chrysalis.
"She knows things," said Brownbread. "Sometimes she tells."
"She's magical."
Wicket waved his long hands as if to demonstrate.
"She does favors. For a price."
Rini could not help herself.
"Who are you? What do you do here? How did you get here?"
"Those are some very, very good questions,"
Corduroy said slowly. He seemed to be the thoughtful one.
"We'd have to give a lot of gifts to the Colleen to get the answers to all those."
"You mean you don't know who you are or how you got here?"
"We have ideas,"
Corduroy said meaningfully.
"But we're not sure. We argue about it some nights."
"Corduroy is the best arguer,"
Wicket explained.
"Mainly because everyone else gets tired and quits."
They had to be puppets, these men. But they seemed somehow lost, remote from the rest of the club's bright glare and knowing blandishments. Rini felt a chill at the idea of constructs, bits of coded gear sitting around a virtual campfire and arguing about metaphysics. It seemed so lonely. She looked up at the glittering lights snarled in the tangle of roots above, like stars, little flames to ameliorate the darkness above, as a campfire stands sentinel against the darkness of Earth.
"Okay," she said at last, "take us to this Colleen."
Wicket reached down and plucked one of the burning brands from the fire. His three friends did the same, their faces suddenly full of solemnity. Weenie couldn't help feeling that in some strange way this was all a game to them. She reached for the final piece of wood, but Corduroy waved his hand.
"No,"
he said.
"We always have to leave the fire burning, so we can find our way back."
Rini helped Habu to his feet. He swayed slightly, as though almost fainting with weariness, but stood by himself when she took her hand away and turned to the men.
"You said we'd have to take her a gift. I don't have anything."
"Then you must give her a story. Your friend Mr. Wande knows lots. He told us some."
Brownbread smiled, remembering.
"Good stories they were."
Wicket took the lead, bending his neck to keep his head below the trailing roots. Whistler came last, holding his torch high so that Rini and Habu were surrounded by light. As they walked, Rini experienced a faint blurring along the edges of her vision. She could never see it happening directly, but the place around them was changing. The feathery roots overhead became thicker, and the tiny lights dimmed. The soft, loamy earth beneath their feet hardened. Before long, Rini realized that they were walking through a succession of caves, with only the torches for light. Strange shapes covered the cavern walls, drawings that might have been done in charcoal and blood, primitive representations of animals and people. They seemed to be moving downward. Rini reached out to Habu, wanting mostly to be reassured of his presence. She was beginning to feel almost as much a part of this place as Wicked and the others. What section of the club was this? What was its purpose?
"Habu, can you hear me?"
There was still no response on private band.
"How are you feeling? Are you okay?"
He was a long time answering.
I am having trouble hearing you. There are other presences, very close."
"What do you mean, other presences?"
"It is hard to say."
His voice was listless.
"I think the people of the early race are near, or perhaps it is the hungry one, the one burned by the fire."
"What does that mean?" She tugged at his shoulder, trying to break through his odd lethargy, but he merely tipped a little to one side and almost stumbled.
"What is wrong with you?"
Habu did not answer. For the first time since she had found him, Rini began to feel truly frightened. Wicket had stopped before a large natural archway. A chain of crudely sketched eyes surrounded it, dark as bruises against the torchlit stone.
"We must go quietly,"
he whispered, lifting a long finger to his lips.
"The Colleen hates clatter."
He led them under the arch. The cavern beyond was not as dark as the corridor outside. At the far end, scarlet light glared from a crevice in the floor, staining the rising steam. Barely visible through the red-shot mist was someone seated on a tall stone chair, still as a statue. The figure did not move, but a voice filled the cavern, a throbbing, growling sound which, despite the clearly understandable words, sounded more like a church organ than human speech.
"Come forward!"
Rini flinched, but Wicket took her arm and led her toward the crevice. The others helped Khabu over the rough ground.
"It's the what's-it-called? The Delphic Oracle,"
Rini thought.
"Someone's been studying Greek mythology."
The shape on the stone chair stood, spreading its cloak like the wings of a bat. It was hard to tell through the rough garment and obscuring steam, but it seemed to have too many arms.
"What do you seek?"
The tolling voice came from everywhere at once. Rini had to admit the whole thing was impressively eerie. The question was, would going through this charade actually help?
"They want to leave," said Wicket. "But they can't."
There was a long moment of silence.
"You four must go. My business is now with them."
Rini turned to thank Wicket and his friends, but they were already hurrying back toward the cavern's entrance, jostling each other in their haste like a gang of kids who had just lit the fuse of a firecracker. She suddenly understood what had puzzled her about Wicket since the first meeting, and about his companions as well. They moved and spoke like children, not like adults.
"And what do you offer in return for my help?"
asked the Colleen. Weenie turned. Khabu had slumped to the ground before the crevice. She squared her shoulders and made her voice as calm as she could.
"They told us we could give you a story."
The Colleen leaned forward. Her face was veiled and invisible, but the shape beneath her robes, extra arms or no, was recognizably female. A necklace briefly caught the light as large pale beads glinted against the darkness of her breast.
"Not just any story, your story. Tell me who you are, and I will set you free."
The word gave Rini a moment's pause.
"We simply wish to leave, and something is preventing us. I am Wellington Babutu of Kampala, Uganda."
"Liar!"
The word clanged down like a heavy iron gate.
"Tell me the truth!"
The Colleen lifted hands clenched into fists. 8 of them. End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Side 7. City of Golden Shadow. Otherland, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 198.
"You cannot mock me. I know who you are. I know exactly who you are."
Rini stumbled back in sudden panic. Strimbello had said that too. Was this all some game of his? She tried to take another step, and found she couldn't, nor could she turn away from the crevice. The burning light was suddenly very bright. The red glow and the dark shape of the Colleen scratched against it were now almost the only things she could see.
"You will go nowhere until you tell me your true name."
Each word seemed to have physical weight, a crushing force like a succession of hammer blows.
"You are in a place you should not be. You know that you have been caught. Everything will go better for you if you do not struggle."
The power of the creature's voice and the constant serpentine movement of the arms silhouetted against the glare were strangely compelling. Rini felt an almost overwhelming urge to surrender herself, to blurt out the whole story of her deception. Why shouldn't she tell them who she was? They were the criminals, not she. They had harmed her brother, and God knew how many others like him. Why should she keep it secret? Why shouldn't she just scream out everything? The cavern warped around her. The scarlet light seemed to burn at the bottom of a deep hole.
"No, it's some kind of hypnosis trying to break me down. I have to resist. Resist! For Stephen. For Khabu."
"Tell me!"
demanded the Colleen. Her sim still wouldn't retreat or turn away. The snake-like arms moved in ever swifter patterns, turning the glare from the crevice into a strobing succession of dark and light.
"I must close my eyes."
But she couldn't even do that. Rini struggled to think of something other than the shape before her, the demanding voice. How could they stop her even from blinking? This was only a simulation. It couldn't physically affect her. It had to be some kind of high-intensity hypnosis. But what did it all mean? Why Colleen? A maiden? A virgin like the Delphic Oracle? Why go to such lengths just to terrify trespassers? It was the kind of thing you did to scare a child. Eight arms. A necklace of skulls. Rini had grown up in Durban, a town with a large Hindu population. She understood now what the thing before her was supposed to be, but people from other places might not understand the Oracle's name, especially children. Wicket and his friends had probably never heard of the Hindu death goddess Kali, so they had come up with their own version. Wicket, Corduroy, they weren't adults, she suddenly realized. They were children, or childlike puppets. That was why she had found them so strange. Here in this horrible place, children were being used to catch other children.
Then this monster thinks I'm a child, too. So did Strimbello.
They had sniffed a false identity, but they had assumed Rini was a child sneaking through the club in adult guise. But if that was true, then Wicket and his cronies had delivered her to the process that had crippled Stephen, and God knew how many others. Khabu was still on his knees, staring helplessly. He, too, was caught. Perhaps had been caught before she had ever found him, and was now as far gone as Stephen. He could not exit. But Rini could, or at least she had been able to a few minutes before. For a moment she stopped struggling against the invisible restraint. Sensing surrender, the dark shape of Kali expanded, looming now so that it filled her vision. The veiled face tilted forward, cloak billowing around it like a cobra's hood. The lights flashed. Words of warning, commands, threats all cascaded over Rini, running together into a ragged drone so loud that it seemed to make her earplugs vibrate.
Exit!
Nothing happened. Her sim remained frozen, an unwilling worshipper at Kali's feet. But that made no sense. She had spoken the code word. Her system was set for voice commands. There was no reason it shouldn't work. She stared into a vortex of swirling red light, trying to hold concentration through the shattering, never-ending noise, struggling to block out the panic and think. Any voice command should trigger her system back at the Poly, unless these people could somehow jam her voice in the same way they had frozen her sim. But if they could do that, why go to all the trouble to bring her to this particular place when Strimbello could just have immobilized her in the Yellow Room? Why put on such an elaborate show? They must need her here, isolated, exposed to this barrage of light and sound. It had to be hypnosis, some method using high-speed strobing and special sonics that operated right at the nervous system level, something that cut in between her higher thought processes and her physical responses, which might mean that she hadn't spoken at all, but only thought she had.
"Exit!"
she screamed. Still nothing happened. It was hard to concentrate. Hard to feel her real body beneath the blinding, jaggedly pulsating light and the painful hum of a million wasps in her ears. She could feel her attacker ripping away at her shell of concentration, the only thing protecting her from a tumble down into nothingness. She could not keep it up much longer.
Dead man's switch.
The words fluttered up, a few scraps of memory shaken loose by the maelstrom.
Every system has a dead man's switch. Something to release you if you get into serious trouble. A stroke or something. The Poly must have one.
It was so loud. So excruciatingly loud. Each thought felt as slippery as an untanked goldfish.
Heart rate? Is the switch hooked into the EKG monitor in the harness?
She would have to assume it was. It was the only chance she had. She would have to try to drive her pulse rate up beyond permitted danger levels. Rini let the fear she had been struggling to check finally burst free. It was not difficult. Even if she had guessed correctly, there was only a very thin chance of this plan working. More likely, she would fail and find herself sliding down a long tunnel into blackness, as Stephen had done before her, a blackness indistinguishable from death. She could not feel her physical body, which was no doubt hanging uselessly beside Khabu's in the harness room. She was only eyes and ears, battered to the edge of madness by the howling whirlwind of light that was Kali. Unchecked and without outlet, desperation ran through her like some horrible silent electrocution. But it was not enough. She needed more. She thought of her heart and imagined it pumping. Now, letting her sheer fright color the image, she visualized it pounding ever faster, struggling to cope with an emergency for which evolution could never have prepared. "It's hopeless," she told herself, and pictured her heart shuddering, hurrying. "I'll die here, or fall down into madness forever." The dark muscle was a shy, secret thing like an oyster ripped from its shell, struggling hopelessly to survive, pumping hard, straining, losing the beat for a moment as the rhythms bounced awkwardly against each other. Streaks of hot and cold went jagging through her, fear to the toxic level, shivers of helpless animal panic, racing, fighting, failing.
"I'll be lost, just like Stephen, just like Habu. Soon I'll be in the hospital, zipped into an oxygen-filled body bag, dead, dead meat."
Images began to flash before her eyes, leaping out of the kaleidoscopic display that filled her vision. Stephen, gray and unconscious, lost to her, wandering somewhere in an empty, lonely place.
"I'm dying."
Her mother, shrieking in agony during her final moments, caught on the upper floor of the department store as the flames climbed hungrily upward, knowing she would never see her children again.
"I'm dying. Dying."
Death the destroyer, the great nothing, the freezing fist that seized you and squeezed you, crushed you into dust that floated in the blank dark between stars. Her heart stuttered, laboring toward failure like an overheated engine.
"I'm dying. I'm dying. I'm dying. I'm..."
The world jerked and turned gray. Light and dark were evenly smeared. Rini felt a sharp pain race down her arm, a streak of fire. She was in some between place. She was alive. No, she was dying.
"I'm out,"
she thought, and the idea rattled in her suddenly cavernous and echoing skull. The shrieking drone was gone. Her thoughts were her own, but even through the agony, a vast, adhesive weariness pulled at her.
"I must be having a heart attack."
But she had already determined her course before she had begun. She couldn't afford to think about what she was going to do. Couldn't pay any attention to the pain. Not yet.
"Backtrack. Last node."
Her voice, though loud against the new stillness in her head, was only a dry whisper. Even before the gray had finished forming, it was gone. The cavern surrounded her again, the red light blazing. Her position had changed. Now she stood to one side of Kali, who was leaning forward over the hunched figure of Habu like an interested vulture. The death goddess's arms were motionless, the maddening voice silent. Her veiled face pivoted toward the spot where Rini had reappeared. Rini leaped forward and seized the bushman's sim. Another jagged bolt of pain shot up her arm. She gritted her teeth and fought off a wave of nausea.
"Exit!"
she shouted, triggering escape for both of them, but aborted immediately when Habu's part of the program didn't respond. Her stomach lurched again. The little man was still trapped somehow, still hooked. She would have to find another way to get him out. A shadow swung across her like a negative searchlight. She looked up to see the scarlet-limbed figure of Kali looming above, arms spread wide.
"Oh, shit!"
Weenie tightened her grip on Habu, wondering how lifelike this simulation was. Bracing herself against the inevitable pain, she straightened suddenly and put a shoulder into the Oracle's midsection. There was no sensation of contact, but the creature slid back several feet into the middle of the steaming pit. The monster hung in midair, bathed in the red glow, feet flattened on nothing. One of Kali's hands darted toward her own face and tore away the veil, revealing blue skin, a ragged hole of a mouth, a dangling red tongue, and no eyes. It was meant to hold Rini until the visual tricks could start again. It might have worked before, but now she had no strength left to be startled.
"I'm so tired of your goddamned game,"
she grunted. Black spots swam before her eyes, but she doubted they had anything to do with the programming in Mr. J's jolly little hellhole. Dizzied, she turned her face away from the blind thing and heard the ululation beginning again. Weenie was having trouble breathing. Her voice was faint.
"Get stuffed, bitch. Random."
The shift was surprisingly fast. The cavern dissolved, and for a moment a long, dark hallway began to form before her eyes. She had a dim perception of a near-endless row of candelabra along the walls, each held by a disembodied hand. Then she was suddenly shifted again, this time without her command and against her will. This transition was not as smooth as the others. For several long instants, her vision was nauseatingly distorted, as if the new location would not come into correct focus. She tumbled and felt soft earth, or the simulation of it, beneath her aching body. She kept her eyes closed and reached out until her fingers touched Khabu's silent, still form. It was hard to imagine moving another inch, but she knew she had to get up and start looking for ways to get them out.
"We have only moments," someone said.
Despite its urgent tone, it was a soothing voice, pitched almost equally distant from the stereotypical extremes of both masculine and feminine.
"They will find it much easier to track you this time."
Startled, Rini opened her eyes. She was surrounded by a crowd of people, as though she were an accident victim lying in a busy street. After a moment, she saw that the forms around her were gray and still, all except one. The stranger was white. Not white as she was black, not Caucasian, but truly white, with the blank purity of unsmirched paper. The stranger's sim, for that was what it must be, since she was clearly still inside the system, was a pure, colorless emptiness, as though someone had taken a pair of scissors and snipped a vaguely human-shaped hole in the fabric of VR. It pulsed and danced along its edges, never entirely at rest.
"Leave us alone."
It was difficult just to speak. She was short of air, and a bright fist of pain was squeezing inside her ribcage.
"I cannot, although I am a fool to take this chance. Sit up and help me with your friend."
"Don't touch him!"
"Stop being foolish. Your pursuers will locate you any moment now." Rini forced herself up onto her knees and swayed for a moment, catching her breath.
Who are you? Where are we?"
The blankness crouched beside Khabu's unmoving form. The stranger had no face and no distinct shape. Rini could not tell what it was looking at.
"I am taking enough risks already. I cannot tell you anything.
You may still be caught, and it would mean death to others. Now help me lift him. I have little physical strength, and I dare not bring more power to bear." Rini crawled toward the shapeless pair, and for the first time took notice of her surroundings. They were in a kind of open, grassy park, pinned beneath dark gray skies, bounded by tall trees and ivy-choked stone walls. The silent figures that surrounded them stretched away on all sides, row after row, making the place seem a bizarre cross between a cemetery and a sculpture garden. Each shape was that of a person, some highly individual, some as featureless as the sims she and Khabu wore. Each had been frozen in some moment of fear or surprise. Some had stood a long time, and like the deserted structures of Toy Town, had lost their colors and textures. But most looked new-minted. The stranger lifted its head as she approached. "When something happens to one of the guests while they are online, their sim remains. Those who own this place are amused to keep their trophies this way." Weenie put her arms under Khabu and lifted him into a sitting position. The effort made the edges of her sight go black for a moment. She swayed, struggling to maintain consciousness.
"I may be having a heart attack,"
she whispered. "All the more reason to hurry," said the empty space. "Now hold him still. He is a long distance away, and if he doesn't return, you will not be able to take him offline. I must send for him."
"Send for him?"
Rini could barely form the words. She was beginning to feel quite drowsy, and although a part of her was frightened by that, it was a small and diminishing part. This human-shaped blankness, the strange garden, they were simply a few more complications to an already complex situation. Difficult to think about. It would be easier simply to let herself roll down into sleep.
"The honey guide will fetch him back."
The stranger held up the blunt white shapes that were its hands, as if about to pray, but kept them a few inches apart. When nothing happened, Rini began gathering the energy to ask another question. But the featureless shape had become as rigidly still as any of the Trophy Garden's other residents. Rini felt a cold pall of loneliness settle over her. Everything was lost now. Everyone was gone. Why keep fighting, when she could let go, could sleep? There was a stirring between the stranger's hands. Then a sort of opening appeared there, a deeper nullity, as though something had cast a shadow onto naked air. The darkness flicked, then flicked again. Then another white shape fluttered out of it. This smaller blank patch, which was bird-shaped in the way the stranger was human-shaped, fluttered onto the shoulder of Khabu's sim, then crouched there for a moment, vibrating gently, like a newborn butterfly drying its wings. Rini stared in lazy fascination as the tiny white shape slid close to Khabu's ear, or the rudimentary fold in his simulation that represented it, as if to share a secret. She heard a high-pitched trill, Then the bird thing leaped into the air and vanished. The larger blankness abruptly shivered back into life. It leaped up and smacked its rudimentary hands together.
Go now. Hurry.
What? Rini looked down. Habu was moving. One of his sim hands clenched fitfully, as though trying to catch something that had flown away.
You can take him back now. And you must take this, too.
The stranger plunged one arm inside itself, then pulled out something that glimmered with a soft amber light. Rini stared. The stranger reached and took her hand with its other arm, peeled open her clenched fingers, and dropped the object onto her palm. She wondered for a moment at the mundane and unremarkable touch of the ghostly presence, then looked down at what had been given to her. It was a round yellow gem, cut into hundreds of facets.
What is it?
It was becoming hard to remember much of anything. Who was this gleaming white shape? What was she supposed to be doing?
No more questions,
it said sharply.
Go!
Rini stared for a moment into the void where its face should be. Something swam through her mind deep down, and she struggled to identify it.
Go now!
She squeezed Habu a little tighter. He felt as slender as a child.
Yes, of course. Exit!
The garden popped like a soap bubble. Everything was very dark. For a moment, Rini thought they had become stuck in transition, until she remembered the headset. She lifted her arm, gasping at the painful effort, but managed to tip up her visor. The view around her improved only a little. She still saw mainly gray, although now there were dark stripes as well. Then she understood that the blurry verticals around her were the straps of the harness room. She was hanging in place, swinging slightly. She turned. Habu was dangling beside her. But it was the real Habu in his real body. As she watched, he shivered convulsively and lifted his head, eyes rolling as he tried to focus.
Habu!
Her voice sounded muffled. She was still wearing her earplugs, but she couldn't work up the strength to lift her arm again. There was something she needed to tell him, something important. Rini stared at him, trying to remember, but her head was beginning to feel very heavy. Just before she gave up, it came to her.
"Call an ambulance,"
she said, and laughed a little at the oddness of it.
"I think I'm dying."
Chapter 12. Looking Through the Glass. Netfeed News. California's multi-marriages now law. Visual. Two women, one man, all wearing tuxedos, entering Glide Memorial Church. V.O. Protesters howled outside as the first of California's newly legalized multi-partner marriages took place at a church in San Francisco. The man and two women said it was a great day for people who don't have traditional two-person relationships. Visual. Reverend Pilker at Church Rostrum. Not everyone agrees. The Reverend Daniel Pilker, leader of the fundamentalist group Kingdom Now, called the new law indisputable evidence that California is hell's back door. Paul stepped through and out. The golden light faded, and he was in emptiness again. The mist stretched away in every direction, as heavy and empty as before, but there was nothing else. There was no finch or mullet either, which was a great relief. But Paul had been hoping that he would find something more on the other side of the glowing gateway. He wasn't quite sure what home meant, but in the back of his mind he had been hoping to find exactly that. He sank to his knees, then lowered himself until he lay stretched on the hard and featureless earth. The mists swirled around him. He closed his eyes, exhausted, without hope or ideas, and for a while gave himself to the dark. The next thing he was aware of was a quiet whispering. A thin, papery sound that grew out of the silence. A warm breeze stroked his hair. Paul opened his eyes, then sat up, full of wonder. A forest had sprung into being around him. For a long time he was content just to sit and stare. It had been so long since he had seen anything but blasted fields of mud that the sight of unbroken trees, of thickly tangled branches still bearing their leaves, soothed his spirit like a drink of water to a thirsty man. What did it matter that most of the leaves were yellow or brown, that many had already fallen to the earth and lay ankle-deep around him? Just the return of color seemed a gift beyond any price. He stood. His legs were so stiff that they might have been things discarded by someone else that necessity compelled him to use. He took a great breath of air and smelled everything. Damp earth, the scent of drying grass, even the faintest tang of smoke. The sense of the living world coursed through him so powerfully and so richly that it awakened hunger inside him. He suddenly wondered when he had last eaten. Bully beef and biscuit. Those were familiar words, but he could not remember what the things they named were. In any case, it had been long ago and far away. The warm air still surrounded him, but he felt a moment of inner chill. Where had he been? He had a memory of a dark, terrifying place, but what he had been doing there or how he had left had slipped from his mind. The very lack of things to remember meant that their absence did not worry him long. Sun was filtering down through the leaves, making spots that swam like golden fish as the wind moved the trees. Wherever he had been, he was in a living place now, a place with light and clean air, a carpet of dry leaves, and even, he tilted his head, the distant sound of a bird. If he could not remember his last meal, well, that was all the more reason to find himself another. He would walk. He looked down. His feet were shod in heavy leather shoes, which at least felt familiar and correct. But nothing else in his attire seemed quite right. He wore heavy wool stockings and pants that ended not far below his knee, as well as a thick shirt and waistcoat, also of wool. The fabric seemed strangely rough beneath his fingers. The forest stretched away in all directions, revealing nothing that looked like a road or even a trail. He pondered for a moment, trying to remember which direction he had been traveling when he stopped. But that, too, was gone, evaporated as completely as the bleak mist, which was now the only thing that he remembered with certainty had existed before the forest. Granted an open choice, he noted the stretching shadows and turned to put the sun at his back. At least he would be sure of seeing his way clearly. He had been hearing the intermittent birdsong for a long time before he finally saw its author. He was kneeling, freeing his stocking from a bramble bush, when something brilliant glided through a column of sunshine just ahead of him, a flash of green both darker and shinier than the moss crawling on the tree trunks and stones. He straightened, looking for it, but it had vanished into the shadows between trees. All that remained was a trill of piping music, just loud enough to claim a single echo for its own. With a stiff tug, he pulled himself out of the bramble bush and hastened in the direction the bird had gone. Since he had no path, he thought he might as well follow something pretty as plod on with no better destination in mind. He had been walking for what seemed hours, and had seen no sign of change in the endless forest. The bird never came close enough for him to see it completely clearly, but neither did it disappear from sight. It flitted from tree to tree, always just a few dozen paces ahead. On the few occasions where the branch it chose for a resting place was in sunlight, he could see its emerald feathers shining, an almost impossible glow, as though it blazed with some inner light. There were hints of other colors, too, a dusky purple like an evening sky, a hint of darker color along the crest. Its song also seemed somehow less than ordinary, although he could remember no other bird's song for comparison. In fact, he could remember very little about any other birds, but he knew that this was one, that its song was both soothing and alluring, and that was enough to know. Afternoon wore on, and the sun passed out from behind the gaps in the treetops, sliding toward the hidden horizon. He had long ago stopped worrying about what direction it shone. So caught up had he become in his pursuit of the green bird. It was only when the forest began to darken that he realized he was lost in a trackless wood with night coming on. He stopped, and the bird alighted on a branch not 3 steps from him. It cocked its head. There was a dark crest, and gave voice to a melodic trill that, though swift and bright, had something in it of a question, and something in it even less definable, but which made him suddenly mournful for his lost memory, for his directionlessness, for his solitude. Then, with a flip of its tail that revealed the midnight purple brushing underneath, the bird spread its wings and spiraled up into the air to disappear among the twilight shadows. A last thread of song floated down to him, sweetly sad, diminishing to nothing. He sat down on a log and put his head in his hands, overcome with the weight of something he could not define. He was still sitting that way when a voice made him jump.
"Here, none of that. These are good solid oaks, not weeping willows."
The stranger was not dressed much differently than he, all in rough browns and greens, but he wore a broad strip of white cloth tied around one arm like a bandage or a token. His eyes were a strangely feline shade of tawny yellow. He held a bow in one hand and a skin bag in the other. A quiver of arrows stood up behind his shoulder. Since the newcomer had made no hostile moves, he felt it safe to ask him who he was. The stranger laughed at the question.
The wrong thing to be asking here. Who are you, then, if you're so clever?
He opened his mouth, but found he could not remember. I don't know.
Of course not. That's the way of this place. I came in after...
I'm not certain, you know. I think it was a deer. And now I won't remember my name until I'm on my way back out again.
Queer, this forest.
He extended the skin bag. Are you thirsty? The liquid was sour but refreshing. When he had handed it back to the stranger, he felt better. The conversation might be confusing, but at least it was a conversation. Where are you going?
Do you know that?
I'm lost.
Not surprised. As to where I'm going, it's out. Not a good place to be after dark, these woods.
But I seem to remember something just outside the forest that feels like a good destination.
Perhaps it will be the kind of place you're looking for.
The stranger beckoned.
In any case, come along. We'll see if we can't do you some good.
He quickly rose to his feet, afraid that the invitation might be rescinded if he took too long. The stranger was already pushing through a tangle of young trees which had made a hedge around the wreckage of their toppled older relative. They traveled for a while in silence as late afternoon twilight gradually deepened into evening. Fortunately, the stranger held down his pace. He seemed like the sort who could have traveled much faster if he chose, and remained, even in the dying light, a dark shape only a few steps ahead. At first he thought it was the night air, that the colder sharpness was bringing a different kind of sound to his ear, a different kind of scent to his nostrils. Then he realized that instead it was a different kind of thought that was suddenly drifting through his mind. I was somewhere else. The sound of his own voice was strange after the long time without speaking. A war, I think. I ran away. His companion grunted.
A war?
Yes. It's coming back to me. Some of it, anyway. We're getting near the edge of the forest. That's the reason.
So you ran away, did you?
But not for the normal reasons. At least I don't think so. He fell silent. Something very important was swimming up from the depths of his mind, and he was suddenly frightened he might grab at it too clumsily and lose it to darkness once more. I was in a war, and I ran away. I came through a door, or something else. A mirror. An empty place.
Mirrors!
The other was moving a little more quickly now.
Dangerous things!
And... He curled his fists, as though memory could be tightened like a muscle. And my name is Paul. He laughed in relief.
Paul!
The stranger looked back over his shoulder.
Funny sort of name. What does it mean?
Mean? It doesn't mean anything. It's what I'm called.
It's an odd place you come from, then.
The stranger fell silent for a moment, though his legs still carried him forward in long steps that had Paul hurrying to keep up.
I'm Woodling, he said at last. Sometimes Jack of the Woods or Jack Woodling. That's my name because I do tramp all the woods near and far, even this one, though I don't like it much. It's a fearful thing for a man to lose his name, although perhaps not so much so when the name doesn't mean aught.
It's still a fearful thing. Paul was struggling with the new ideas that were suddenly skittering through his head like beetles. And where am I? What place is this?
The Nameless Wood, of course. What else would it be called?
But where is it?
In what country?
Jack Woodling laughed.
In the King's Land, I suppose. The old King's Land, that is. Although I trust you've got the sense not to call it that among strangers. You may tell her ladyship I said so, though, if you meet her.
His smile blazed briefly in the shadows.
You must be from somewhere far away indeed that you concern yourself with such schoolmasterish things as the names of places.
He paused and pointed.
There it is, then. As I hoped it would be.
They had stopped on a high place at the edge of a narrow valley. The trees fell away down the gradually sloping hillside. For the first time, Paul could see some distance in front of him. At the bottom of the valley, nestled between the hills, a cluster of lights gleamed. What is it?
An inn, and a good place.
Jack Woodling clapped him on the shoulder.
You will have no trouble finding your way from here.
But aren't you going?
Not me. Not tonight. I've things to do, and elsewhere to sleep. But you will find what you need there, I think.
Paul stared at the man's face, trying to make out the expression through the night shadows. Did he mean more than he said? If we are going to split up, then I want to thank you. You probably saved my life. Jack Woodling laughed again.
Don't put such a burden on me, good sir. Where I go, I must travel light. Fare you well.
He turned and moved back up the hillside.
Within moments, Paul could hear nothing but the leaves rustling in the wind. The sign swaying in the wind over the front door named the inn The King's Dream. It was crude, as though it had been put up hurriedly to replace some earlier insignia. The small figure painted below the name had his chin on his chest and his crown tipped low over his eyes. Paul stood for a moment just outside the circle of lantern glow puddled in front of the door, feeling the great trackless weight of the forest breathing like a dark beast at his back, then stepped forward into the light. Perhaps a dozen people were ranged about the low-ceilinged room. Three of them were soldiers in surcoats, as bloody red as the joint.